This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Super Bowl 49 is less than a week away. The Seahawks and Patriots meeting at the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, Sunday night. This hour, we're talking about the teams, the spectacle that is the Super Bowl, the ads, the halftime show, and we'll also take a look at the NFL. 2014 was a year of controversy, and yet viewership is higher than ever. Joining us for the first half hour are John Quinn, who's in studio with us. John is sports editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much, Mary.
And Art Kaplan is on the phone with us. Art is an ethicist at the Langone Medical Center at NYU. Hi, Art.
Hey, how are you?
We're well, thanks. So we're going to start off with the big issue this past week. Of course, that is the raging controversy over deflated footballs. In brief, the Patriots are accused of using underinflated footballs in their romp over the Colts for the AFC Championship because quarterback Tom Brady likes them that way. Brady and head coach Bill Belichick have denied this. And, John, first to you, it's hard to figure out whether this was a really serious breach.
I think it's not really a serious breach. I think every team does this. If you read a story by Bill Pennington 2 years ago with Eli Manning, it was in the New York Times, every quarterback needs his balls to be specific. Some like them more inflated, less inflated. Depends on what kind of receiver you throw to. Patriots throw a lot of short passes. Receivers use their hands to catch them coming out of the backfield. So the less PSI pressure, the easier it is to catch the ball.
Yeah, but there's a regulation. There's a standard, right, for inflation?
There's a standard for inflation, and the balls actually do go to the referees at some point. They come back to the team, and there's an hour before the game starts. So somehow, I mean, I have leaky tires, put air in my tires today, and I'm sure the pressure right now is less than when I put them in. So somehow, miraculously, the pressure decreased, and Tom Brady was very happy.
I'm sure he was. And I mean, but the bottom line is, and Art, let's get you into the conversation here too. Would it have been a closer game if the footballs had been inflated to their proper pressure?
It would have been 38-7 instead of 45-7. Okay. I mean, it absolutely had nothing to do with it.
So what?
They scored. They reinflated the balls in the second half, and I think the Patriots scored 21 points on passing touchdowns. So no, it really didn't affect the outcome. I was pleased to see, as a proponent of more science for the American people, that Boyle's Law, which is the relationship between pressure and temperature, was getting a good workout here last week. There's nothing like physics visiting the NFL, but it paid a temporary visit. I think the only reason this really came up is that there was a history of cheating by the Patriots. They filmed and sort of surreptitiously stolen signals over the years. And so I think people, when they heard about this, just jumped on it, partly because of Brady, Belichick, the Patriots. I think that triggered some of this. But did it impact the game? Absolutely not.
So, but, you know, if you're not found out, then it's just gamesmanship, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, as John said, you know, people in hockey curve their stick and hope that they don't get detected before game time. They get more of a shot out of their stick, the more curve they have on the end of it. They're always pushing the limits. There's plenty of ways in which people are trying to play mind games and actual push the rules to the limit games. Every NFL coach talks behind that, you know, handheld, what do they call those things, with the plays on them. They're little boards. They're always covering their mouths. We can presume that's because everybody thinks they're trying to steal signals all the time.
Is there a name for that, John, yeah, those little boards?
No.
So we can call them the anti-lip reading devices.
There you go. So at the end of the day, what do you think Commissioner Roger Goodell should do?
Well, I have a novel idea. I think the last time the Patriots were penalized, they took away a draft pick. I think that they should take away timeouts in this game, particular game.
In the Super Bowl.
In the Super Bowl, and Seattle should get the ball both kickoffs, both halves. And that would be fair.
All right. I can't tell whether you're saying this tongue-in-cheek.
So it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. The point I'm making is that what's a real penalty and what's not a real penalty?
Sure.
Okay. And for a draft pick, is not a real penalty. But if you said, okay, you can't get all your timeouts, then people may pay a little more attention to the rules.
Yeah, I think we're probably agreed that nothing's going to happen before the Super Bowl, right?
Oh, no, no. I mean, here's the thing. You don't know if other teams before this in the previous games had done this. I think most teams do it or do something different, not necessarily the same deflation of the ball, but some other issues.
Well, you know, for me, I think the league might want to take more charge of the balls. I mean, the idea that you bring your balls and scuff them up and prepare them the way you want and control them, I'm not sure why the league isn't supplying both teams with the balls. They can scuff them up themselves. That's kind of what baseball does, using, by the way, Delaware Valley mud to rub all over baseballs before the umps get them. You know, to me, it's as much an issue of how much control do you want to have over equipment, whether it's a goalie shoulder pads, which got pretty big over the years until they finally cut back on that because they were clogging up the entire goal area. No one could score. Mm-hmm. Or handling the footballs. You know, you need a third party to really audit and check. And if the NFL wants to do that and become like the IRS, that's the direction they should go.
At the end of the day, though, knowing Tom Brady, do you think this is going to affect him on Sunday?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, he's getting a kick out of it. It's deflecting all of the discussion from everything else that you might want to, you know, try and. I mean, he's going up against the best secondary in football. He's going up against one of the greatest defenses of all time. And nobody's talking about that. And he's, you know.
It's not going to distract him?
No, not at all. Oh, no. He's got Gisele Bündchen as his wife. What's going to distract him?
I'll say this. I think it might even give him a little edge because they can now use this to say the whole world's against us. Here they are again accusing us of being a bunch of non-deserving cheats and we earned it and, you know, it's us against the world. They may actually get a little bit of a bump out of this on the Patriots side.
And at the same time, the attention is off the Seahawks.
And the Seahawks defensive backs have a better chance to catch the ball if it's less airing it.
Okay. Hey, can I jump in with one other thing? We spent the whole week talking about Deflategate and the relationship between pressure and temperatures. But, you know, during that game, one of the stars of Seattle, Sherman, had a very badly injured arm. The quarterback apparently might have been concussed by a really vicious hit that he took during the game. No one paid attention to that all week. And these are, you know, I thought the league was getting all hepped up about safety and we were going to make sure that everybody had a concussion protocol and it's all right to let your kid play. I didn't hear much attention paid to the fact that, you know, what's a guy doing out there basically holding his arm and playing? Shouldn't the doctor have benched him?
Yeah, I did want to get to that at some point in this hour, but why don't we tackle it right now? No bad pun intended.
Okay.
the fact is, Russell Wilson, there was concern that he'd been concussed. And with everything that was going on over the last year or so about, you know, the health of players and how this should be happening, He wasn't pulled. He wasn't taken to the side. If he was at the sideline, it was a short conversation.
Yeah, I think you have to use the concussion protocol. If you use the concussion protocol, then you have to do step A, B, C, and D. And if you don't use the concussion protocol, you could just say, hey, I want to go back in the game. They were losing the game. They were getting beat. They were very fortunate to win. And I don't think that Russell Wilson was going to come out or they were going to let him come out. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're driving a car and the officer says, get out and take the breathalyzer, then you got to take the breathalyzer. And then if you blow a 1.5, you're going to jail. But if you never take the breathalyzer, nothing happens.
Yeah, it depends on whether the coach wants to or even the player wants to apply the breathalyzer.
Right.
It's,
I mean,
it's pretty arbitrary.
In this case, you know, I mean, there are some times when, you know, there was a big play, Michigan University earlier in the year where the quarterback got knocked out and was woozy walking back to the huddle and the coach didn't take him out and they just left him out there. I mean, that was obvious. I don't think it had reached that state.
So the bottom line is there are no clear and fast rules as to when you take a look at concussion or other injuries and determine whether to bring somebody out.
Well, no, there are rules, but you have to address them as a concussion protocol. In other words,
but I mean, there's no set procedure for, hey, there might be a concussion protocol needed here. There certainly wasn't
It's sort of optional. I mean,
game.
At that point, it's a judgment call, I guess.
So for me, the doc saw the hit. Everybody saw the hit. Plenty of speculation about shouldn't they run through the concussion protocol. And I think if the NFL is going to convince mothers to let their kids play junior high school, even peewee football, tackle football, you better err on the side of concussion assessment. And I'm going to say it again, letting this guy run around out there with one arm, holding onto his other, it might make for some good stories of heroism and, you know, stick-to-itiveness and I'm going to overcome the pain. But from a health point of view, I don't take the league seriously when that guy's still out there.
Sure. Art, I also wanted to go off on a little bit of a different tack here. Dave Zirin, in writing for The Nation, makes the point that 2 hours after the president's State of the Union address last Tuesday, the number one topic trending on Twitter was about deflated footballs. What does this say, if anything, about our cultural focus?
Well, State of the Union can have a lot of adventure, too. You may say there are many brain-damaged people there, and maybe we should wonder how they got that way, but you know, overall, I'm not surprised by that difference. I'm not surprised by that difference. The State of the Union, for most Americans, you know, what do we got? Something like 25, 30% of the country voting in presidential elections, less than the off years. We have a problem in the culture in terms of taking our democracy seriously. We don't have a problem in the culture taking our football seriously.
Okay. John?
Well, Eric Holder was a basketball player at Stuyvesant High School, captain of his team. So I think there's a lot of sports. Obama likes to play basketball. The problem with the Deflategate, I think, has to do a little bit with how things trend on Twitter, things trend on Facebook, even newspapers that try to get hits, websites that try to get hits. Stories that get aggregated because it's a hot story. And what happens is that, you know, you see Chartbeat, and if it's trending on Chartbeat, then it becomes the number one spot, and then it becomes sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that people just – anybody could talk about Deflategate. I mean, you know, my son's making South Park jokes, you know, about – because they use the word balls, you know, and it's Tom Brady, okay, and they're goofing around. So, I mean, sure, it just went all across the spectrum of people just having fun with it.
So this was a story really that was a non-story that was blown up by social media?
I think that had something to do with it. I don't think it was just because of social media, but I think it added just a whole nother level. And anytime, you know, if you're talking about trending over the State of the Union, I mean, yeah. I mean, for what really happened, Deflategate, I mean, the balls were, you know, slightly under, you know, inflated. I mean, that's absolutely nothing. So.
Time to put it to bed.
Okay.
Okay. Our guests are John Quinn, sports editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer and sports fan and ethicist, Art Kaplan. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoen. We've got a break coming up, but we'd love it if you join the conversation. What do you think? The number is 888-477-9499. Who do you like on Sunday? Give us a call. Let us know. We're right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoen. Super Bowl Sunday's coming right up. We're talking about the Patriots-Seahawks matchup this hour with John Quinn, sports editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Art Kaplan, ethicist and former football player, not on the pro level, but I think he got up to the semi-pro level. As always, we'd love to hear from you, listening from wherever you are, 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and a tweet works as well, @WHYY Radio Times. So let's get to the actual game, Patriots and Seahawks. Give us a thumbnail sketch of each team. John, let's start with you.
Well, I think it all starts with Tom Brady, and I think it starts with the short passing game, and I think that they are hitting on all cylinders. The big win over Indianapolis was a perfect example. I mean, they have not won a Super Bowl in 11 years, and they want this really bad. This is the biggest thing for them. I mean, they have been a top-notch team. People are going to start talking about Brady can't win the big one. And they are just so much better. I think Seattle got lucky last week. I think Seattle had a great run last year. Some of the defensive guys are hurt. I think this is New England big.
What do you think, Art?
I think it's New England, too, although I'm not sure I'd say big. You know, Seattle turns out to be a very powerful running team. Marshawn Lynch, even Wilson himself, the quarterback, they've got a driving game, and certainly the New England defense is good. It'll be interesting to see whether they can contain that run game. I don't think of fans necessarily appreciating how important that running game is, but Lynch, last in the championship series, boy, did he run roughshod. He was a beast, just amazing. So if they can really establish the ground game, I think Seattle could keep it close, but I agree. I think the Patriots really want this for a lot of reasons, and I think they are hitting their stride at the right time, and I think Deflategate will psychologically help them. I think Belichick is smart and a great coach, and he'll use it to pull the team together.
Let's look at Russell Wilson for just a moment. I mean, there are flashes of brilliance there. This is his second Super Bowl appearance in 3 seasons.
Uh-huh.
He had some pretty amazing plays in the last 4 minutes of the game. I don't know what happened to him in the first, 55 minutes. But can you really count him out?
I think, no, Russell Wilson, I mean, he's amazing. He's a gamer. I mean, you know, you can separate quarterbacks. You can forget about stats. You get the ball 3 minutes ago, 2 timeouts, 80 yards, do you win the game? And he won the game, and he wins the game. He was a great quarterback in North Carolina State. He transferred senior fifth year to Wisconsin. He was a steal of the draft. The Eagles missed on him. They wanted to take him, missed him in the second round. He just does the intangibles to win games. And I think and he was very emotional after that last game. I mean, he was incredibly emotional. I think that, you know, sometimes they won it last year. Getting back to the Super Bowl was a big deal for them.
Sure.
I'm not so sure that they're ready to win it again. I mean, they use a lot of emotion to win that game.
And Tom Brady's what? He's 37. So is this? You know, I mean, how much longer can he keep this up?
Oh, he can do it forever. I mean, he does not get hit. He does not get hit in the pocket. He has wide receivers that run the right routes. He puts the ball where it needs to be. He could go another 5 years. I mean,
really?
If he wanted to, he'll go as long as he wants to. Now, his legacy will be determined by if he wins this game or not. If you look at John Elway, he played for a long time. He didn't win a Super Bowl till the end. Then he went 2 in a row, and now people consider him one of the greatest of all time. Before that, you look at Peyton Manning, he only has 1 Super Bowl win, so people started questioning his legacy. So I think Tom Brady wins one, but I think, I mean, they have enough talent. He probably wants to win another one, and they're loaded.
Okay.
Don't you think, though, in a lot of ways, Brady, his legacy is established. He's now moving into the debate about best of all time kind of things. You know, he's, what are they, in their 6th Super Bowl appearance?
Yeah.
He's got quite a track record. So I'm going to say he's now competing and racking up credits, best of all time kind of stuff in the Joe Montana, you know, versus John Elway versus Brady kind of debate. And I agree. He gets protection, and he's in great shape. He seems to be, you know, savvy enough to avoid any big collisions. He gets rid of the ball when he needs to so that it doesn't get hit. He could go at least a few more years should he choose to.
All right. I'd like to switch gears here a little bit because no matter who you like or don't like, whether it's your city's team, people are going to be watching this game. The Super Bowl is spectacle. And people are watching despite the awful year the NFL had last year, the domestic abuse stories that came out. First of all, what is the NFL doing solidly to combat domestic abuse? John?
They did make some changes, but it took a lot of pushing and prodding. You know, there is some awareness now. I think that they are acting decisively when the next time something happens. And so far there have been some minor players involved where they do get suspended. And then they do look at hard possible treatment for what the issues are, which, of course, they did not do with Ray Rice. In fact, they still did not handle that right. They did not handle Adrian Peterson right at all. I mean, the owners of the teams didn't handle it. The commissioner didn't handle it. And they were left holding the bag. And it was very embarrassing for the league. So now at least they act, but they don't act decisively. They didn't even act decisively with Deflategate. I mean, nobody knew what the protocol was for footballs, and they still haven't explained it. You know, so I don't know what it is with them, but they think that they can not deal with things properly in a timely fashion because they're so big, there's so much money, and it's one of the hugest corporations there is.
And maybe it doesn't make it right, but maybe they are right in that. People are still watching, and ad revenues are up.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I think that's a phenomenon. I think that's, you know, you look at Philadelphia. I mean, this is an Eagles town now. Even, I mean, the Phillies are in a World Series, but it's still an Eagles town. And you look at Baltimore, it's a Ravens town. I mean, the NFL has reached such incredible proportions. People from around the country root for specific teams, even if they don't have a team in their city. They play fantasy football. You know, there's even fantasy football betting now. I mean, it's the golden egg right now. I mean, they have to be careful because, of course, it could always go away. But
yeah, I want to jump in there and say if they don't get on top of domestic violence, if the game is still associated with concussion and huge risk to the players, and they still have this bullying thing going on in the background about how they deal with homosexuals or just the locker room behavior, anything, you know, it's hard to mention anything overturning the NFL's success, but they have some real cancers, incipient cancers eating away at this golden goose. And I do think they've got to do a better job. PSAs are not enough. I think they got to educate the players and manage them better. I think they got to reach into the college ranks and see what they can do about educating players there, be careful about who they draft. I mean, they do have a culture problem in the NFL with a lot of things that I think, let's say parents are watching and they're thinking, do I want my kid to play this game and do I want my kid to root for this kind of character?
But at what point is the NFL forced to do anything? We're far from that point, aren't we?
Well, the interesting thing is
concussions, you know. I was just going to say, on concussions, I think they're getting forced, right? Lawsuits are moving behavior there, and they had to fess up to damage relative to former players pulling together. And they're certainly trying to sell themselves as a safer league. You know, they have a lot of PSAs on to reassure moms about safe tackling and safe technique and that sort of thing, although I'm a little skeptical of all that. But in that area, the lawsuit moved them. In some of these other areas like domestic violence, boy, you've got to, as John said, you got to move quick and you got to be decisive and you have to show that you're doing systematic things to get on top of the problem, not just responding by saying that guy's banned for a year.
I think is when they come out for the NFL draft, when the college players come out, they go to the NFL combine, sort of like a meat market. You run through a bunch of drills. But they have a lot of deep psychological testing and deep interviews about a personality, and what happens is that you can't hide anything because they have investigators that will find out. So when Michael Sam came out, one of the reasons was because people were going to find out and that it was going to affect his draft status. But in college, he came out with his team, and his team was fine with it. So when you look at any NFL team, you have anywhere from 50 to 60 guys. And, of course, there's going to be conservative. There's going to be liberals. There's going to be people who could handle it. And there's going to be people who could be haters. That's what a team is made out of. But if they accept somebody, then they're fine. So I think from that point of view, it's okay. From the concussion standpoint, I mean, they're finding out now. You know, Kevin Cobb was a quarterback for the Eagles, and he ran out of the pocket, and he got hit from behind, and he went face down, and his helmet was in the grass. He came up with a bunch of grass in his face mask and went off the field, and that's how he got his concussion. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a helmet-on-helmet classic ESPN moment where you said, oh, my God, look at that. They're finding out that high school kids have concussions.
Sure.
College kids have concussions. Then you get to the pros, and now you've had 27 concussions. Maybe only 5 of them have been legitimately classified. And so now he's having trouble. I mean, when Dave Duerson, I mean, that was probably, well, Junior Seau and Dave Duerson were the most amazing, scary moments when Dave Duerson, a lawyer, most respected player in the league, played with the Chicago Bears, great defense, played at Notre Dame, high profile. and he basically couldn't take it anymore, and he killed himself, and he shot himself in the chest so that his brain could be preserved for further testing.
Yeah.
You know, years ago, Jim Otto was an Oakland Raider center. This was in the 70s and 80s, and he came back to a reunion, and he couldn't walk. And somebody said, oh, my God, look what's happening to these guys.
The bottom line is, before we wrap it up here, the NFL moves slowly.
Way too slow. They don't want to pay.
Way too slow.
Yeah. They don't want to pay, and it's a bottom line industry, and the commissioner is paid by the owners, and that's the thing that we sometimes forget. We hear the word commissioner in baseball and football and others, and what we don't realize is they're paid by the owners. They're thinking about.
And by the
owners.
Way, so are the doctors, and so are the trainers, and that's not a good setup if you're going to push safety.
Got it. All right, Art Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us. Art is an ethicist at the Elango Medical Center at NYU. We appreciate it. And also John Quinn, sports editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Our next guest is Bob Thompson, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. And we are looking at the Super Bowl now as the event. Bob, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So is there anything else like it worldwide as far as a single game in its ability to attract viewers and advertising dollars? And, you know, I'm thinking of the World Cup soccer final that comes to mind.
Right. Yeah. Well, worldwide, I think there are some things that compete with it. But in this country, there is nothing even close. And I'm not talking about just comparing it to other games or other sporting events. There are really no other events that get this kind of an audience. I mean, television, which, of course, has traditionally delivered the biggest audiences ever. All of its shows and things, the ratings have been going down as there are more and more choices. Super Bowl ratings have, in fact, been going up. 111 million people is about as big an audience as you ever get in this country, and you can count on it year after year after year. The Super Bowl is in a class entirely by itself as a cultural phenomenon.
It wasn't like this, obviously, starting out. How did it develop into the behemoth that it is?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, first of all, football and television were a match made in heaven. And that's not true of every sport. Baseball and television don't mesh as well. Baseball is something that's better watched in a field that doesn't have the pacing of that television requires and so forth. But football and television were perfectly matched. And we were showing football games on TV when TV was just starting. As we moved into the modern era, though, and the Super Bowl started, there were a couple of things it had going for it. Number one, it was a winner-take-all situation. So you knew when it was going to happen, and you knew when you could throw the party to have people over. With the World Series, you couldn't do that. Do you schedule your party on Game 4, Game 5, Game 7? You don't know when it's going to end. So I think that was an important element. What I think it really started moving along, though, was many years ago when the commercials began to be a parallel program. Super Bowl now is actually three shows. It's the football game, it's the halftime show, and it's the film festival put on by Madison Avenue with all these commercials. And it's been, 10 years since it's become a cliche to say, we used to go to the bathroom during the ads, now we go to the bathroom during the game. and that's made it possible for all of these people who are not football fans to find something to engage in during all of these Super Bowl parties. And, of course, Super Bowl Sunday is one of the most meticulously observed holidays in our entire 12-month calendar.
Hey, Bob, let's get to the ads. The asking price for a Super Bowl ad this year is $4.5 million.
That's right, for 30 seconds. That's $9 million per minute.
But you know what? NBC executive Seth Winter says the true value of exposure for advertisers is closer to $10
million. Well, it is true. You get a lot for the buck when you buy a Super Bowl ad, because not only do you get the ad played to the largest audience of the entire year, But you've got people talking about these ads for weeks before, then they're analyzing them for days after, and now, of course, with digital dimensions, you can have people who hear about these things and then watch them again. So if you put out $4.5 million for a 30-second ad on the Super Bowl, it is likely that ad is going to be talked about, replayed, seen in many, many other different places than that one particular half a moment it plays on the Super Bowl. So in that sense, that's why it gets $4.5 million.
Do you have
a
favorite?
On the other hand, I think it often depends on the ad, whether it really helps to move product or if it just really amuses people who promptly forget what it was even advertising.
Do you have one that you like in particular?
Well, my favorite Super Bowl ad of all time was the black and white, it looked like a John Ford Western with cowboys herding cats. And even though it's my favorite, and even though I do this for a living, I swear I couldn't tell you right now what that ad was for. I think some kind of financial services.
They'd probably be devastated to hear that.
What?
They'd probably be devastated to hear that.
It was a great 60-second film. It was, I think, a terrible commercial. And there is a difference between a great film and a great ad. And I think in Super Bowl, that difference is often completely forgotten.
Budweiser's Puppy Love Spot last year got, I think it was 55 million views alone. What is the magic formula for a winner?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different categories they fall into. Animals obviously tend to be really popular, but they don't always work. Animals behaving like humans are often very popular, but they don't always work. Babies behaving like adults often work well, but not always. So I think there is this sense that there's a couple of categories that successful Super Bowl ads have fallen into. But just like, you know, just because a game show becomes popular on TV doesn't mean you can just make a bunch of game shows and they'll all be popular.
All right, Bob.
Sentimentality and tears work good in a Super Bowl ad if it's a good Super Bowl ad, not so much if it's not well executed.
We're going to take a break right here, but we'll be right back. Bob Thompson is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We are talking about the Super Bowl this hour. Why do you watch? Is it for the game, the ads, or maybe the party? Call us at 888-477-9499, or you can email Radio Times at Radio Times or Radio Times at WHYY.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Bob Thompson is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. And Bob, let's look at the Super Bowl, the halftime show. Katy Perry's doing it this year. It's going to be a big, big event, big spectacle. But again, it wasn't anything like it was today until Michael Jackson took the stage. What was it, just over 20 years ago?
Right. You look back at the early Super Bowls, and there were marching bands, you know, which is what halftime shows used to be. 1970, the Southern University Marching Band and Carol Channing were the performers. That tells you how different things have become. But like everything else, as Super Bowl began to emerge as something more than just a football game, and as the television entertainment industrial complex began to realize what Super Bowl was all about, we moved away from marching bands and up with people and these kinds of things to these big, anointed superstars in the pop world, which they thought they could maximize their audience with. And it's a complex equation, because if you've got the game, which is the whole reason the show is there in the first place, and then you've got people sticking around for the advertisements, you've got to make sure your halftime show is compelling, or you know, or that's when people go to reheat their nachos and diaper the kid or whatever it is they should have been doing for the last 2 hours. And Super Bowl has managed to put almost this seamless thing together where there's a sense that you've got all these people in the room and constantly putting something that they want to watch. And now with the halftime show, since Janet Jackson in 2004,
oh boy,
with no other reason, something really important could happen in that halftime show.
Sure. Well, you know, on a more somber note, we were talking earlier in the show that you know about the NFL and its handling of things like domestic abuse cases. And People Magazine says Katy Perry, they make the point that Katy Perry is going to feature anthems of female empowerment. Is it a stretch to say that this has something to do with the choice of Perry for the halftime show?
No, I think these choices are obviously thought out to within an inch of their lives. I mean, there was a very careful decision of the kind of performance that I think it was Paul McCartney did after the year after Janet Jackson. I mean, you're always trying to manage. These decisions are about commerce. They're about advertising. They're about audience. But they are also about politics. And I don't think Katy Perry is by any means a coincidence. I don't know how far that message is going to go or how many people are actually going to read it as such. And as you were talking about with a couple of your other guests before, there is a sense that, I mean, you're right, this has been a bad year for the NFL, and you enumerated in the first half of your show, but it doesn't seem to matter. In spite of concussions and domestic violence and all of the rest of it, if you looked during the season at the top 10 highest-rated shows of every week, football often occupied four of those top ratings. Oddly enough, just doesn't seem to matter. This behemoth.
Why? Why does it not seem to matter, in your opinion?
Well, I think there is so much infrastructure. I mean, football is so deeply in the American consciousness in general. And then you've added to that the gambling and then fantasy football and then online dimensions. And, of course, football is live, and live programs are very, very amenable to the new digital revolution. And then the long tradition of Super Bowl. I mean, this has become established for many, many people don't remember, most people don't remember a time when they didn't go to or have a Super Bowl party. Here would be the equivalent. Let's say all of a sudden Thanksgiving had a horrible year. And in some ways, Thanksgiving over the last couple of decades has had horrible years.
We've begun
to rethink our relationships to Native Americans and what happened after that landing on Plymouth Rock. But all of that stuff has not done a thing to stop people from eating a turkey and having a bunch of relatives over on Thanksgiving. It's almost as though the cultural presence of this is so powerful, the inertia is so hard to overcome, that it's going to take something significant to change that. I think, by the way, that significance is coming, but it certainly hasn't arrived yet.
Okay. Let's get a website comment from Millie. She says, I'm disgusted with the lack of honesty and sportsmanship in the New England Patriots team. The idea that they would have won the game regardless is completely irrelevant. And, of course, we're talking about the deflated footballs. They cheated. There should be an immediate and noticeable penalty. They should not be allowed to play in the Super Bowl. It would have to take a pretty big transgression for that to happen, Bob.
It would. I don't know what happened with these deflated footballs. Most of what I know, I've been hearing from comedians on late night television shows. Obviously, if in fact this happened and if people were cheating, then I agree with what the person says there. On the other hand, getting down to the bottom of these stories when so much of the information has been being controlled by an organization that has their best interests in mind is really, really tough to do.
Bob, who gets to go to the Super Bowl, which is, again, it's being held at the University of Phoenix Stadium this year? Tickets at $5,000 apiece?
No, you're right. These are not the things that Dad decides to take the kids to at the last minute. That's an interesting point in that the Super Bowl is a television show, pure and simple. And that's how most people, 99.99999 repeating, who see it, are going to see it. And that game is played, as most football games now, according to a clock that television determines and according to the needs of television. So oddly enough, actually being there is become one of these kind of elite bonus high pedigree sorts of things. It's kind of like going to, instead of watching The Daily Show or Jimmy Fallon, one night you actually go and you're there in the audience to see it. What you see when you actually are there is not the Super Bowl as everybody else knows it, but it's a prestige kind of thing, and it carries a really big price tag.
Oh, we've got it. We've got this email from Bernie. He says, I watch the Super Bowl to distract me from thinking about the many more important things facing our society, such as the unprecedented income gap between rich and poor, an Orwellian government that monitors our communications, movements, and transactions, government corruption at all levels, etc. Bread and circuses keep me happy and ignorant. Ignorance is bliss. Go Super Bowl. You know,
he's like a $4.5 million 30-second commercial of an almost naked woman eating a Carl's Jr. hamburger to fall into the category of bread and circuses.
Yeah, well, you know what? He speaks for a lot of us. We need distraction.
Well, although I think from the sounds of it, he was being very ironic. The idea that, yes, we need distractions, but it's in fact the perpetual distractions that are keeping us away from the things that we should be thinking about. I think he was being ironic there. I guess I'm not sure.
I think so. Let's get to the TV piece of it a little bit more, Bob. Even during the regular season, the NFL is working to draw viewers. To ensure, apparently, the biggest audience on any given Sunday, it does something called flex scheduling. In other words, the league can alter the schedule weekly so the best matchup is moved to primetime.
Right, which of course makes perfect sense. I mean, you're obviously going to want to go with any of your content, as they now call it, that's going to maximize your audience. And moving the best matchup to primetime, having regional games play in different parts of the country, which can maximize your audience. I mean, that in many ways is just good business sense. And that's one thing the NFL is very good at. They've also, over the past several years, been making a real effort, in spite of all this domestic violence stuff, to appeal to the growing number of women who are watching football. Now, the Super Bowl is a kind of a different sort of thing because it's a big holiday and social occasion and party. But the Super Bowl, 45% of the audience of the Super Bowl on television are female. And I think that's something important to remember. And you can see it sometimes in the ads and the decisions of halftime performers, but sometimes less so. But it's really an attempt to continue to grow the audience of football. And one of the places to do that is with women. An interesting point. Syracuse University, where I teach, has got a long tradition of producing sports broadcasters. Marty Glickman, Bob Costas, Mike Tirico, a big, long line of them. And it was almost always, when I first got here in the early 1990s, it was always almost always the male students that wanted to go in the footsteps of those sports broadcasters. Over half now of my students who are completely committed to lives as sports broadcasters, people on television doing sports, are now female.
Really?
I think a lot of that has not been a coincidence.
Okay. Question from Kevin. He'd like you to discuss the pay-to-play scheme for halftime. And I'm not sure if this is the case, but he's heard that performers are now going to have to pay if they want to perform.
Okay. Yes, this was reported in the Wall Street Journal, and last I heard, and I may not be completely on top of the story, but last I heard, the NFL had denied this. But there had been a story reported that the NFL not only was not going to pay people in for their halftime performances, but they were going to have to pay either by a fee or maybe by a percentage of their concert take afterwards, and it was unclear, and I think it's been denied unless more has broken on that story. Now, when you first hear that, you think, that sounds absolutely absurd. Who would do that? But think about what it means to be crowned a Super Bowl performer.
Oh,
now,
sure.
Granted, many of them now that get invited to Super Bowl are already superstars. But it can mean a big deal for your career. When Bruno Mars performed the week of Super Bowl, his album sales went up 180%.
Mm-hmm.
This is better for exposure than all the music awards show put together. Because let's remember, if 111 million people are watching, some of those are your fans and you're singing to the converted, but a lot of those people may have no idea who you are and maybe like you and maybe become a new fan. It's a great promotion not only for the products that advertise, but for whoever gets to perform.
Okay, and we've got a question from Adam. He asks, what happens if there's another blackout during the game? How do they respond on TV?
Well, I suppose kind of how they responded on the first blackout. I mean, there's backups. I don't know what their engineering department has going, but there can always be. Sometimes the impending disaster can be bad weather in a place that it's played where there's potential snow. A big disaster during, like a blackout or a big mess up. Is always, I suppose, a possibility.
Well, you know, speaking of that and how the Super Bowl city is chosen, usually they're warm weather venues, but, you know, we're noticing some cold weather spots sneaking onto the schedule. I think Minneapolis is up in the future.
I think so, too. Yeah, there have been certainly Super Bowls played in places that have been very risky to schedule an outdoor event in February. I don't think anybody would ever dare do it here in Syracuse, New York, where it's still snowing in May. But they've certainly been scheduled and have been played in places where, you know, weather could obviously cause all kinds of hassle. It's amazing how Super Bowl has been going for as long as it has. And there have been blackouts, and there have been exposed breasts, and there have been a few things here and there. But for the most part, there haven't been any real sort of fundamental structural breakdowns in the system since it started.
And it feels like real football when it's played in cold weather. I'm sorry.
that's true, too. And that's the one thing. On television, I swear, when I watch Super Bowl now with all of the digital 10-yard lines and all the rest of it, it's so much more closer to playing a video game than it is to actually going to a stadium and watching a football game. And I think bad weather or blackouts, some of that stuff at least remind us that this whole thing isn't programmed in some robotic studio someplace, for the most part it is.
That's an interesting observation, Bob. So what are you looking forward to in this Super Bowl? Anything new and different?
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's because I've been doing this for a long time, and maybe I'm just getting to be a grumpy old cynical person. But
no.
I have to say that Super Bowl is a night I feel like is one of my working nights. It's a night that I have to work on Sunday, and it goes for a long time. And I watch with a clipboard, and I watch every commercial, and I watch the game. But and again, this might just be my age, but Super Bowl gives me so much less pleasure than it did back when Carol Channing was doing the halftime show.
That would have been fun. I don't remember seeing that one. Well, I take it you don't have a team in the game then, huh?
Well, as a lifelong Cubs fan, I'm not somebody one should ever, whoever I'm supporting tends to not win.
Well, Bob Thompson, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Bob is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, where he's also a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. And this reminder, you can find out more about our program, including our Facebook page and podcasts, by visiting whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.